This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Steven Spielberg, one of the most revered filmmakers in Hollywood. Whether you know him from the terrifying thriller Jaws or the dark portrayal of Abraham Lincoln in Lincoln, his films have been making cultural impact since the 1970s. Steven Spielberg, a child who knew he wanted to make films, got a photography merit badge after the Boy Scouts let him make a film instead of still pictures. That film was a Western and the beginning of what would become a rich body of work that tackles everything from aliens to slavery. This month in Movies on the Radio, we're going to take a look at the films of Steven Spielberg. And joining me are film experts Marcia Gordon, a film professor at North Carolina State University and a National Humanities Center fellow. Hello again, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
And Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series. Hello to you, Laura.
Hello, Frank.
Steven Spielberg, why is he great? Talk about his enduring career in Hollywood and the variety of films that he's done. Pretty incredible director.
He really has a gift for manipulating emotion in an audience so that you react to a film exactly the way he wants you to react. Well, maybe Marcia does laugh at the crying scenes.
Wait a second.
Cry at the laughing scenes. I don't know. But, I mean, he's very good at eliciting emotion from the
audience. Well,
I'm
in the same boat. I will save you from this because I will say, absolutely, that's his genius. And if you can see through that, if you do have the sense that that's his genius while you're watching the movie, which happens to me, then some of the power of the movie is lost on you.
This is both a way to praise and to critique Spielberg, is that he has an amazing capacity at emotional manipulation, which means that he is a master of the craft in some ways. And yet some of his tools are fairly heavy-handed. And so I think some people, I've noticed when you bring Spielberg up, think that he is the best filmmaker of all time. Others think he is about the worst. And I think it's the dividing line in many ways between people who are willing to kind of give themselves up to something that's not going to let you think too much on your own. I mean, Spielberg's films take you on a very clear path. The music tells you how to feel at every turn, lest you have any questions. Mm-hmm. And he's incredibly commercially successful. Right. Not always. I'm sure we'll talk about some of the big wins and the big losses in his career. But consistently, I mean, since the 1970s, has made so many films that have done so well at the box office that you cannot deny that he is, kind of one of the enduring filmmakers of American cinema.
A real craftsman, yes.
He really has his hand on the pulse of the zeitgeist, too.
Yeah, yeah.
He seems to know what kind of movies the audience wants to see, and then he provides that.
And, you know, I just recently skimmed through Joseph McBride's excellent biography of Steven Spielberg again, and just kind of reading about the focus that Spielberg had from the time he was an incredibly young boy. I mean, when he was a child, he was the family home movie maker, and he started making amateur films. And McBride talks about the fact that in eighth grade, he made a World War II movie called Fighter Squad, and he cut in Castle film footage with his own footage very imaginatively. And then when he was 18, he did a feature film on film. Okay, this is not iPhone stuff. This is on 8mm film. A sci-fi film under $600, which is kind of like a proto version of Close Encounters. So this is someone who was self-taught. He did not go to film school because he did not get in, by the way, unlike many of the other filmmakers of his generation, like Lucas and Scorsese. But he had this kind of focus, and he just interned at Universal and got on the lot, and that's how he learned how to become a filmmaker.
Was making movies at a very early age, but really kind of cut his teeth on TV. Did a lot of TV directing well, and made a number of TV shows that he directed, and this made-for-TV movie called Duel.
Why didn't I leave right away when I saw his truck outside? Then I'd know what he intends to do. What if he followed me out, though? Started after me again? I'd be right back where I started. Even if I got a lead, he'd overtake me soon enough. He's got some souped-up diesel. My car's just not that powerful. I just can't drive 80 at 90 miles an hour. A soon as I stop concentrating, I go back to 60 or 70 like I always do. It's a habit. I can't help it. He's just... Take it easy. Maybe I should try some kind of contact. Well, I better do something. Look, mister, I'm sorry if I irritated you. Why don't I buy you a beer and get this thing straightened out, huh? Look, mister, I'm sorry if I irritated you, but let me,
From the 1971 TV movie Duel, starring Dennis Weaver, one of Spielberg's first big breaks, talking about it with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyce.
So, this aired on ABC as a movie of the week. And if you've not seen Duel, this is a film I think is just absolutely fantastic. This is one of my favorite Spielberg's films. This was basically a film about a truck, a very wonderfully cast, ominous truck, and its driver, who you never see. And so it really is, the truck is the monster in this film. And Dennis Weaver, whose voice you just heard, basically is harassed by this truck. Now, this sounds like maybe a bad film school idea. Like, okay, so here's the idea. There's a truck, and it's trying to kill this one guy over the course of the film. Think of scenarios to do that. But if it is that, what Spielberg does with the execution of it is just so masterful, because he creates all of these different set pieces. Just when you think, like, surely there can't be anything else that this truck does, it is truly a menacing, menacing figure. And hearing Dennis Weaver in that monologue, think about how, is he crazy, questioning his sanity, but he's got to somehow, you know, save himself from this monster truck. And it's just delightful.
Well, right away, he has divined something that everyone is afraid of, that you drive in your car and somebody in another car that you don't even see could kill you. I mean, this is a basic fear that I certainly have every time I get in a car. And it's expanding it and embellishing it in a very creative way.
And also the idea that there's no motivation in this. There's no reason that this truck would be doing. There's nothing rational about it. And that's the scariest thing, right? When you have an irrational monster, so you can't determine what it's going to do. And so this film, by the way, did so well. It made such an impact that it ended up being released in theaters after the success on television.
It's Movies on the Radio today on The State of Things. Talking about Steven Spielberg, who did a film called Jaws, I think.
My name is Bob Platt from Raleigh, and my favorite Steven Spielberg movie is Jaws.
The torso has been severed in mid-thorax. There are no major organs remaining. May I have a glass of water, please? Right arm has been severed above the elbow with massive tissue loss in the upper musculature. Indicates the non-frenzy feeding of a large squalus, possibly longimanus or Asurus glaucus. Now, the enormous amount of tissue loss prevents any detailed analysis. However, the attacking squalus must be considerably larger than any normal squalus found in these waters. Didn't you get on a boat and check out these waters?
No.
Well, this is not a boat accident.
I was a big fan of Psycho when that came out with Anthony Perkins. The terror, you know, and the music, too. John Williams was conducting, a 75-piece orchestra. And he actually wrote the score and the music. Like in Psycho, the music of the camera angles, too, you would see, when Hitchcock was doing Psycho.
Yes, they map beautifully right on top of each other. We're talking about Jaws, though, 1975 Steven Spielberg film.
Is there anyone who ever goes into the ocean that doesn't, for at least a fleeting moment, think that there might be a shark there? I mean, he's certainly changed the way people bathe in the ocean, for sure.
I think people still actually go in. People who haven't seen the film always walk in and go, no, no, as you're walking in. But I do that all the time.
Yeah. Well, this is one of those films that if I'm teaching like an introduction to film class at NC State, I will often show, you know, one of the shark attack scenes without the music and let the students just watch it. Then I'll ask them to close their eyes and just listen to the music and then watch it together. And you know what? It's so instructive about one of the things that's powerful about this film, which is that relationship that Spielberg has had to John Williams and absolutely direct ties to the music in Psycho. And actually in Duel, there's music that's resonant of Psycho as well. So this was something that was on his mind for a long time. And it's one of the powerful tools that he uses to manipulate the audience. Right. And any good filmmaker is trying, in the Hollywood tradition, to manipulate the audience to a certain extent. But this film, I mean, I think it's important to say that this was the biggest box office success in American film history. It broke every record when it came out. And so this is the boy wonder gets kind of solidified as like this is someone who everything he touches turns to gold.
And it changes the way films are released. It changes the way films are marketed. And part of its genius is that he figured out a way to balance terror with humor that is not easy to do. I mean, there's so much terrible comic relief in scary movies, and yet you laugh at something, and then the shark comes to bite you.
Those bobbing torsos had me going all afternoon.
And that's part of the inheritance of the Hitchcock tradition.
Exactly.
Movies on the Radio, Steven Spielberg, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State, Laura Boys, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series. More Spielberg on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Movies on the Radio, Steven Spielberg, Marcia Gordon, Laura Boys. Let's talk about a little bit about his moment in film history, because if you remember, you know, you come through the 1960s, the star system is breaking down, the studio system is breaking down, and there's this kind of democratization of film, right? We want to see more verite, you know, not all this Hollywood gloss. And so by the end of the 60s, filmmakers like Spielberg, maybe Lucas, were saying, hey, what happened to movies already? Is that part of what was going on here, do you think? Is Spielberg part of that movement to bring boffo movies back to the screen?
Well, he wanted movies to be fun. Raiders of the Lost Ark is a direct reference back to Gunga Din and various
Buck Rogers
movie serials. You know, there's totally a place for Dog Day Afternoon, but you don't want to see it
right,
every day.
Right.
Yeah, and I do think that the whole movement towards the independent, low-budget films that were being made at the time, Easy Rider is an obvious, easy example of that. I do think that part of what Spielberg and Lucas, you know, with Star Wars, which came out not long after Jaws, were doing was, yeah, reclaiming the big-budget character, get lost in the world of the story, seamless universe films that seem to have been falling out of favor, especially with young people.
My name is Seungjin Lee, South Korean. Fortunately, this year I'm working at the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park in North Carolina. So my memory of watching his movie is happened on the other side of the globe, Seoul, South Korea, in the early 1980s. My mom, a movie lover, often took me and my sister together to one of the two famous movie theaters in downtown Seoul. Back then, those two movie theaters, one of them was called Dansongsa, very much a Korean name. The other one was very funny, the Piccadilly. They competitively ran Spielberg's films, and two of them come to my mind immediately. One is Indiana Jones.
Get back to Cairo. Get us some transport to England. Boat, plane, anything. Meet me at Omar's. Be ready for me. I'm going after that truck.
How?
I don't know. I'm making this up as I go.
Oh,
Oh, wow, that action and that fantastic sounds is still pounding my heart. But I still remember that movie-going experience with my mom. So Spielberg's movie is not just a fun experience for the just individual moviegoer, but that also connects to my good memory with my mom and my childhood.
There we go. Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones, and apparently made it all the way to South Korea and made it big.
I love that one of my colleagues at the Humanities Center got to call in to talk about that. You know, I have the same memories just in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles, going to these movies with my mom in particular. Certainly Raiders, E.T., not Jaws, by the way. But that experience of going to these big movies that everybody was seeing. Yeah. And I remember lines. There were lines to get into the movie theater because this is before you reserved a ticket on the phone. And everyone was having these shared cultural experiences. And even, you know, in this case, Raiders of the Lost Ark, I just rewatched it. I hadn't seen it probably since it came out. And, you know, it's this great pulpy comic book adventure, flawed though it may be in many ways. But it, you can't deny it's kind of a rollicking good time. I looked up Sheila Benson in the LA Times called it, said that basically it had no pretensions to importance. And that's what was great about it. And you can't say that about every Spielberg film, but this is one of those films.
He was reclaiming family movie going, because that's another thing that happened in the 60s and 70s. There were movies for adults and there were movies for children. And you wanted to have that experience with your family of everybody enjoying the same thing. And Raiders of the Lost Ark is a crazy enjoyable movie. It doesn't take a breath in between its set pieces. The scenes roll like that big boulder at the beginning, and you don't have a chance to catch your breath. It's fun, and you leave the movie theater smiling. And that just does not happen all that often.
And it has wonderful sight gags. I mean, Spielberg was also really bringing back some of that comic adventure, rollicking good time.
Another great family movie, E.T.
Hi, my name is Denise Seeley, and I'm from Cary, and my favorite Spielberg movie is E.T., That's because my boyfriend of probably just a couple weeks and I went to see it on, you know, one of our first dates. I started to cry when E.T. died.
He must be dead. Because I don't know how to feel. I can't feel anything anymore.
And I probably cried till he woke up. Well, here's my boyfriend trying to figure out what to do, so he puts his arm around me and soothes me and said, everything's fine. And that was great. So a couple weeks later, a bunch of friends said, well, let's go see it again. And I thought, sure. My husband thought, okay, I'm safe. She's already cried. She knows he's going to live. Everything's fine.
E.T. phone home.
Does this mean they're coming?
Yes.
Then I start crying before he dies because I know what's coming. so it's that I think he finally realized what a tearjerker means. But the truth is, my boyfriend, who is now my husband for 37 years, whenever we sit down to watch E.T., he'll put his arm around me because he knows that I'm going to cry.
Here we go. E.T., 1982.
So this is another one of the kind of greats in the early Spielberg filmography. And I think one of the most, I just rewatched it for the show. I hadn't seen it in so long. And this was one I was really glad I rewatched because it is so artfully done. There's virtually no dialogue in the beginning of the film. I mean, Spielberg manages almost wordlessly to set up this idea of the alien not an invader coming to take over the world, but, you know, just this little dude that gets left behind by, we don't really know, that's not the issue is not why are the aliens here and what are they doing to us? It's just like the little guy that gets left behind. And then when we meet E.T., 15 minutes into the film, he's ugly and slimy. I mean, he's not, it's not the cheap, easy way to make a super cute alien. And you come to have this attachment to him through the eyes of this young boy whose family's going through a divorce and is trying to figure out his world. And it's just, it is really wonderfully executed.
And crying at the movies is also a pleasure because it's a way that you can have a personal catharsis. And it's exactly the same with me. You cry the first time and then you start crying earlier on subsequent viewings. But yet this, in many ways, because it is so emotional, my daughter growing up became terrified when the men from the government come in with all their plastic and their jingling keys. And she,
as you should be.
And she freaked out so badly. She kind of lost what happened at the end of the movie. I think you have to be a little older to be able to process, you know, all of the humor and the love, and then to have the fear come in. It's very powerful.
And young people out there, if you've not seen this and you are a Stranger Things fan, you need to go back to it because it's one of the urtexts for Stranger Things. And it was also, it knocked all the box office records that had been already established by Jaws and then by Star Wars out of the water. This was another one of those big ones.
And let me please recommend the Bollywood version to Koi Mil Gaya.
Okay.
Vithik Roshan is excellent.
By the way, no one has ever pointed this out, but it is further evidence that a wall in that case would have done no good.
That's true.
No good at all. Well, we're talking about the blockbusters and having his finger on the zeitgeist, if you can do that. I don't know. Can you touch a zeitgeist?
I don't know. That's why I hesitated,
finger
because
on the zeitgeist.
I wasn't sure.
I know
I
what you meant.
I believe we say pulse.
Finger on the pulse. But then we wanted to say, because there's poltergeist
pulsing,
and zeitgeist. But he did
zeitgeist.
A lot of, then he takes his turn, especially in the 80s with the Color Purple.
Hi, my name is Kimberly. I am calling from Clayton, North Carolina. My favorite Steven Spielberg movie is The Color Purple. The movie is beautifully shot. I'm from the South, and all of the scenes in the movie that are from the rural South just made the South look really, really beautiful. It was a joy to watch. Now, as far as the story is very sad, but it's still beautiful. Some of my favorite scenes in the movie that made me cry. The number one scene that made me cry, and my favorite scenes are those that make me cry. But my favorite by far is when Suge was singing at the jug joint, and she kept hearing gospel music being sung at her father's church down the road.
I bet you think I don't know nothing.
All of us have been prodigal children at one time or another. And I tell you, children, it's possible for the Lord to drive you home, but he can drive you home.
And the look on her face when she realized, oh my gosh, I'm getting ready to cry. The look on her face when she realized that she could not keep singing. And she started walking toward the church and they all followed her. And when she stopped singing and she stands there and she's wait for her father to react to her, and she's so vulnerable.
See, Dad, sinners have soul too.
Yeah, it's a clip from The Color Purple, first of Spielberg's historical films. Movie stars Whoopi Goldberg, Danny Glover, Oprah Winfrey, based on the book by Alice Walker. I'm talking about Steven Spielberg's films today on Movies on the Radio with Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon.
And this was Oprah Winfrey's first film role, Whoopi Goldberg's second, I think. So it's hard for us to imagine not knowing, you know, them as the women they are now. This was a very interesting film, an interesting shift in Spielberg's career away from these clearly going to be big blockbuster, fun, spirited films to starting to think more about American history in particular. And this was, of course, based on an Alice Walker novel. And I mean, I remember when this came out, I mean, this it got a ton of Academy Awards, although, I mean, not awards, actually nominations, and no awards were given. Spielberg did not get nominated. It did very well at the box office, despite the fact that that there was some concern about the subject matter not being conducive to getting people to go to the movies. And the critics and audiences were so divided between really praising the film and really coming down and being very critical, especially questioning what is this white Jewish director doing making this story about African-American women. And so there was a lot of debate and controversy about that at the time.
Well, in a way, it's you know, with great power comes great responsibility. He made all these gigantic films, and now he was thinking, well, I can make any movie in the world. Well, maybe I want to make some that actually has, you know, some depth and meaning to it.
And Joseph McBride, actually, in his biography, talks about when Quincy Jones, who's one of the producers, was trying to talk Spielberg into making the film, and he had some reservations about it. He basically said, you know, you didn't have to come from Mars to do E.T., did you? So, you know, this, it's okay to do this film. You have the budget and the capacity and the imagination and the storytelling skills to do it. So he was really talked into it.
Well, and it's interesting because, again, those questions about why does, as you say, a white Jewish director do a film about African-American women? And but the other question, the reverse, was when is the white Jewish director going to do a movie that has to do with themes within his culture, within the Jewish culture? And he finally does Schindler's List. And here he is talking about that and about sort of coming to the decision and how he did that. He was talking to Lester Holt on NBC when he said this.
I wasn't really ready in my own life because I was making movies about extraterrestrials and movies about, you know, Indiana Jones and sharks, and I was into kind of mass popular entertainment concepts, and I wasn't ready to go personal like that. And I received the book before I ever made the two personal movies that allowed me to make Schindler's List. The first was Color Purple, and the second was Empire of the Sun. And those, for me, were the stepping stones that gave me the courage to take on a story of the Shoah.
So that's Steven Spielberg last year talking to Lester Holt about his 1993 movie, Schindler's List.
And of course, he's gone on to have a huge dedication to recording the real stories of the survivors with the Shoah Foundation that's at the University of Southern California, that he was inspired to do this by the filmmaking. And he's not only been recording the memories of Jewish Holocaust survivors, but has gone to expand that to other genocide victims to try to really make a difference in the huge burden of hate that our species seems to embrace all too frequently.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a bunch of things that are interesting about this film. I mean, on the one hand, the thought of like a black and white 3-hour film having any commercial about the Holocaust, having any commercial viability. I mean, it's hard to imagine that like in a pitch. And yet Spielberg managed to make this film that was wildly successful in terms of box office. I mean, well beyond anything you could have imagined, I think, given the description. But also, I think, you know, despite the fact that some people critiqued it for why would you focus on a Nazi story, the good Nazi narrative, I mean, it did kind of open a gateway to have a conversation about the Holocaust at a time when denial was in the air yet again, and for Spielberg to embark on this other documentation project with these video oral histories.
And I've never been able to watch this because I know it would be hugely upsetting and nightmare provoking because I appreciate Spielberg's cinematic ability, and to implant the images and the stories in my subconscious is just something that I could never take on.
You know, and actually one of the other critiques of it was that there is something profane about trying to represent some of that, that it should just not be represented because it is so sacred and so disturbing.
But yet movies are so powerful, and this is the way we continue to remember.
That's right.
It's Movies on the Radio today on The State of Things. Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon, we are talking about Steven Spielberg today. Another one of the historical moments in American history that he chose to take on was the 1997 film Amistad.
I met my ancestors. I will call into the past. Far back to the beginning of time. And beg them to come and help me at the judgment. I will reach back and draw them into me. And they must come. For at this moment, I am the whole reason they have existed at all.
From the 1997 Spielberg film Amistad, 4 Academy Award nominations, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys, this edition of Movies on the Radio. Tell us more about this film.
I actually haven't seen this film since it came out, so I do know that it was, I guess if you were doing the ledger of Spielberg's career, that you could put this along with Empire and the Sun as kind of critically acclaimed films that were not particularly commercially successful. So I don't think this is a film that made money, but it's part of this commitment that Spielberg has to kind of looking back at American history and representing some of the stories of its past that are, some of the more difficult narratives to engage with. Right.
Well, there's a Jewish philosophy, Tikkun Olam, to heal the world. Mm-hmm. And I feel that taking on some of these difficult subjects is his contribution to that kind of worldview.
Let's take a look at one more film before we take a break, Saving Private Ryan.
The 3 men are brothers, sir. I've just learned that this afternoon their mother's going to be getting all 3 telegrams. That's not all. There's a 4th brother, the youngest. He parachuted in with the 101st Airborne night before the invasion. He's somewhere in Normandy. We don't know where.
Is he alive?
We don't know.
There we go. Saving Private Ryan won 5 Oscars. The film gave Spielberg a win for Best Director. Movies on the Radio today. Laura, you have not seen this film.
You are correct about that, because I know how precise it is in its reproduction of the horrible massacres that occurred on D-Day. But he also has this great engagement with what was called the Greatest Generation. And along with Saving Private Ryan, he also did the Band of Brothers series, also with Tom Hanks, a way of reclaiming a little bit of his father's history, because those of us in that generation, our fathers were all, they all fought in World War II in some way or another. And it becomes sort of an organizing principle for the whole family.
And because of my interest in the war film and in World War II in particular, this is a film I've seen many times. And I will say that that D-Day sequence, I mean, if you have not seen this film, this is a pretty stunning recreation of something that's hard to imagine how to really give audiences an experience of. And Sam Fuller used to say that the only way to make people feel like they had seen a real war film was to shoot out from behind a screen occasionally so that they would feel the terror. And Spielberg does not do that, needless to say, but he comes pretty close in terms of a visceral experience.
Movies on the Radio with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Spielberg films today. We'll be right back. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Movies on the Radio today. Steven Spielberg. We're talking about his films today with Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon. And you.
I'm Amy from Clayton. And my favorite Spielberg movie is AI, Artificial Intelligence. I think this movie gets overlooked a lot. It's not quite as snappy as some of his other movies. I love it because it's so existential and introspective. It raises more questions than answers, and it's actually more about humanity than artificial intelligence.
In a distant future, in an age of intelligent machines, he is the first robotic child programmed to love and coexist as a member of a family. His is a tale of humanity and a journey to find his place among humans and machines.
It also has a great message about grief, but my favorite thing about it is, you know, if you can get through the whole thing, I know it's not as fast-paced, but the ending is just beautiful. It's just the most wonderful ending. Of course, it makes me cry every time.
And as the day wore on, David thought it was the happiest day of his life. All the problems seemed to have disappeared from his mommy's mind. There was no Henry. There was no Martin. There was no grief. There was only David.
That's from the 2001 film AI, Artificial Intelligence. Spielberg movies today with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Why do you think this one was overlooked?
Well, I'm not sure that it was entirely overlooked. I mean, this started off as a Stanley Kubrick project, and in some ways you can't imagine any two more different filmmakers than Kubrick and Spielberg. But Spielberg took it over after his passing, after Kubrick's passing. And this is a Pinocchio story that it's actually hard for – is this really 18 years ago this film came out? That's and now that we are confronted with AI and really thinking about – what does it mean to think about a responsive, maybe sentient entity that's not human? This is, I think, film that that bears rewatching at this particular moment. And I think it's a very interesting pondering of what human consciousness is.
It's interesting that he does so many historical films, but he also looks forward to developments in technology with AI, and even to the cloning in Jurassic Park, which is a topic that comes up all the time now as various kinds of gene splicing becomes more commonplace. So you can look backward and look forward as you try to synthesize humanity's future.
And I think it's worth pointing out, Spielberg does not write all of his own stories and write all of his own screenplays. Some directors do. And he mines, I think, very intuitively and smartly some of the most interesting writers in sci-fi and in history. And so I think he has a real curiosity about certain areas, and he knows how to pick them.
And he's a showman.
Yes.
Right. Well, as you say, I mean, really understands those things that we care about and that we're worried about. I mean, let's take Jurassic Park, for instance.
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh. Say again. We have a T-Rex.
Well. Put your hand between your knees.
Dr. Grant. My dear Dr. Sattler. Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Clip from Jurassic Park, a definite blockbuster for Steven Spielberg, and again, one of these kind of speculative, what-if kind of sci-fi movies.
And certainly the pinnacle of screaming, laughing, screaming, laughing, yep. Screaming, laughing. And when I saw this, I thought that the dinosaurs were so believable. It really seemed like they must have had auditions and they picked the best actors.
Well, but I think it's an interesting point that Spielberg, I mean, obviously this is a film that's so reliant on CGI and on this cutting edge movie making technology, which Spielberg has really embraced over the years as it has evolved and changed. And yet, it's not just the CGI. I mean, I've seen so many of these films that I'm like, oh my gosh, it's just...
Make it stop!
It's just a display of technology. Right, right. I could care less about any of it. But Spielberg never forgets the characters and the story. And that is why he has had the career that he's had, because technology is great. They come in and out. They can be used in the service of story.
One of the stories that never ends is the political culture of America, something that he takes on in The Post, released in 2017.
This is a devastating security breach that was leaked out of the Pentagon. The most highly classified documents of the war.
The Times has 7,000 pages detailing how the White House has been lying about the Vietnam War for 30 years.
The way they lied. Those days have to be over.
Okay, people are concerned about having a woman in charge of the paper.
That she doesn't have the resolve to make the tough choices.
Thank you, Arthur, for your frankness.
Let's do our jobs. Find those pages.
You're talking about exposing years of government secrets.
Is that legal?
What is it you think we do here for a living, kid?
Ben, I might have something.
It must be precious cargo.
Just government secrets.
The New York Times was barred from publishing any more classified documents dealing with the Vietnam War.
If you publish, we'll be at the Supreme Court next week.
Meaning?
Well, we could all go to prison.
That's from the 2017 Spielberg film The Post, nominated for Best Picture Academy Awards.
If we ever needed a film about the freedom, importance of freedom, and the kind of heroic nature of the press and of journalists. I would say the time is now. And so Spielberg, I think, made this film at the perfect time in our history in terms of imagining, in this case, the Washington Post and thinking about the importance of newspapers to our democracy.
And he certainly hurried this through after the election in 2016. He was working on at the same time on Ready Player One, which is a much more complicated film. But he thought it was so important that it get out. And I also want to appreciate the fact that Tom Hanks has been his muse over the last few years. Tom Hanks, the most, you know, quintessentially maybe American hero actor right now, and the collaborations that they've done together are just really wonderful.
See, it made me sad because it reminded me of a time when actually a story like that about you as president, when all that evidence came out in the Washington Post,
yes,
and the New York Times,
yes,
that would derail, that would end the presidency, because the American people would see that and they would say, well, that man's not fit for office. It reminds me of a time when that was true about America.
Yes.
Free press is still very free. In fact, you can go on right now and say anything you want. And those days when Walter Cronkite's voice and the Washington Post was not owned by Amazon.com, I'm just saying, it actually made me sad to think that that moment is no longer an America that I can that I live in.
Well, but I think sometimes when you are a filmmaker of someone like Spielberg's status, who can make pretty much anything he wants, you can make films like this as a signpost and a reminder and a warning, right? And so that's what this is.
Since
you mentioned Ready Player One, let me just say also that, you know, in terms of thinking about the way people interact and rely on their devices and the way class can be stratified now by living in a kind of virtual environment, I thought that film was an incredibly important, like, kind of wake-up call to people for thinking about the way they spend their hours and dollars.
And if you can sugarcoat, a tough message, that makes it all the more powerful.
You know, I'm not much for the sugar in my movies. But it's okay. The guy's a genius. I'm saying the guy's a genius.
You heard it here.
Just not for everybody.
A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine get down, Frank.
And, you know,
just saying.
Needless. A spoonful. I don't need a 5-pound set.
And that is, you know, and we didn't talk, we didn't get a chance to talk about this with Saving Private Ryan, but that kind of hyper heavy-handed emotionalism that bookends the film with the scene of the veterans and Normandy. I mean, that's the stuff that people say, that's an easy critique of, like, why do you have to lay it on this thick at the end? And others would say, look, these are people who sacrificed everything. They deserve every bit of kind of emotional valorization possible. So I think this is one of the dividing lines with Spielberg.
Well, where nobody doubts his genius is this ability to find out the thing that scares you the most.
Hi, my name is Stephanie, and I am from Pittsboro, North Carolina. My favorite Steven Spielberg film is Poltergeist.
This development was built on a cemetery. This isn't just a few spirits we're dealing with. It's a poltergeist.
We just want our daughter back.
The door to the world could close at any moment.
If that happens,
there's no getting her back. I want you all to clear your minds. They already know what scares you.
What's great about Spielberg's direction in this film, as with some of his other films as well, is that he's really able to capture the child's point of view. He captures those real fears that a child has, and it's not in an artificial way. And again, I was the same age as those kids in the film, so that was one why it resonates in that way. But I think that I've always felt that about his films, that he's able to capture that child's perspective. And it's very scary for those scenes more than anything else, where it seems like normal things that are just become creepy and scary from a child's perspective.
1982 horror film Poltergeist, directed and co-written by Steven Spielberg.
Actually, he did not direct Poltergeist. Oh. He wrote it and produced it, but obviously had a very heavy hand in it. And I want to kind of pick up on what the caller just said about the perspective of youth, which is certainly, if you look at the body of Spielberg's work, so many of his films are indeed seen through the eyes of children. I mean, I think of that scene in E.T. with Elliot with the ball coming out of the shed when he first encounters the creature when we are about to see him for the first time, and just the way everything is told through this perspective of kind of youthful kind of openness and curiosity and fears. One of the obviously important texts to Spielberg is Peter Pan. He made Hook, of course, with Dustin Hoffman, right?
Dustin Hoffman, right.
In the 90s. And so
Robin Williams.
And Robin Williams. And but that idea of what it means to be a child and then to have to grow up and what you lose through having to grow up. I think that's been one of the themes throughout the kind of fictional works.
And it's interesting that as much as he reveres childhood, he is willing to grow up and be an adult and make Schindler's List. He doesn't live forever in his childhood like so many directors seem to yearn to do.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the variety of films. He has taken on all kinds, so you won't get him stuck in a genre. We're talking, it's Movies on the Radio today on The State of Things. Marsha Gordon and Laura Boys. Catch Me If You Can. Now, there's a fun film he does, and it almost seems in some ways a departure. Would you say Leonardo DiCaprio, con man who's made millions pretending to be a Pan Am pilot, a doctor, a prosecutor? I mean, it came out of the newspapers, but he turns that into a fascinating little romp.
It's a hugely enjoyable film, also with Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio. And this was a film that my daughter saw and became obsessed with. She watched it over and over. She read the book written by Frank Abagnale. She connected much more with the compulsive liar in Catch Me If You Can than she did with poor little Elliot at E.T.
That's how compulsive liars succeed. You become captivated and you stop asking yourself. Yeah.
And Joseph McBride, in his biography of Spielberg, actually kind of places this in the Spielberg filmography in relation to the idea of the broken home and children of divorce, which Spielberg was, and kind of talks about the way that that his characters deal with the idea of having your kind of family world fall apart. Where do you take comfort? How do you reinvent yourself? Who do you identify with? And like Empire of the Sun, which we really didn't get a chance to talk about, with a very young Christian Bale about the Japanese invasion of Shanghai during World War II, is all about a young boy who's trying to figure out how to survive being separated from his parents. And he has a dubious father figure played by John Malkovich, who, in a wonderful role. But anyhow, the point being is that it's all about how do you figure out the world when you are on your own and your world's falling apart.
Are there other directors who have succeeded so well for so long? How does he compare it? This is decades now, from the 70s.
Well, Scorsese, I would say, it's comparable in some ways. Although, you know, it's interesting. Of course, Scorsese has made so many different kinds of films as well. Spielberg, you know, he's working on this version of West Side Story right now, which would, I believe, be his first musical. But he's worked in so many other genres. Scorsese, we think of so much in relationship to the gangster genre, although he's done so much more than that as well. But I think Scorsese is probably the best point of comparison in terms of the duration of his career.
But he's never cared about making family movies all that much.
What about his impact on the industry in general and on popular culture? Hard to assess.
One of the ways it's hugely influential, Spielberg not just has directed and written all of these films, for which he's made the movie industry billions of dollars, but as a producer, producing Back to the Future and Men in Black and all these other things, he's made other billions of dollars with things that he hasn't even directed. I mean, even his producing instincts are very commercially successful.
And again, this is something that he's been criticized for, the kind of crass commercialism of some of the product stuff. I mean, if you look at E.T., I mean, Reese's Pieces and all the kind of product stuff that gets placed in his films. You know, E.T. seems to be this heartwarming, endearing, sincere film, and yet it's filled. I mean, but it's the perfect way to sum up Spielberg with the kind of commercial and the sentimental.
Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State and a National Humanities Center fellow. Laura Boyes, film curator of the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series. Fabulous stuff, and we'll do it again next month.
Yay.
What do you say we... Well, oh, by the way, Laura's going to be hosting a screening of Mad Love this Friday, October 18th at the North Carolina Museum of Art. And the next Movie Diva screening at the Carolina Theater in Durham is Crossing Delancey on Wednesday, October 23rd.
Thank you, Frank.
That's going to be... And that's at our website if you missed that. Okay, next time, Movies on the Radio, conspiracy and cover-up movies.
This should be good.
Why did you pick conspiracy movies, Marcia?
Maybe it's in the air right now.
What
was
that all about? SOT at WNC.org. Tweet at us at hashtag SOT movie. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hull of Mormon. Robin Copley's our technical director. Jenny Lawson engineered today's show. And Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.